Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle, and you are listening to The Schwepp, the secret history of Western esotericism podcast online at schwepp.net. Special episode, coming back for more, part 7, Reincarnation in Early Christianity. Well, gentle listeners, now things are going to get Gnostic. Many of the writers discussed in this episode, and some of the sectarians lying behind the writings, will be people who were indeed described as Gnostics in the heresiological literature. And at least one of them, Simon the Samaritan, better known as Simon Magus, seems not to have been Christian at all, but rather a religious entrepreneur competing with the earliest Christians for converts, perhaps jumping on the Christian bandwagon at some point, or the Jesus movement bandwagon, and teaching a particular and interesting worldview all his own. Indeed, Simon's existence in our evidence is one of the main reasons people have posited the pre-Christian Gnostic myth. See, there's Simon, Christianity hardly even exists yet, and he's going around preaching Gnosticism. Well, whatever he was actually preaching, his teachings, as we have them, are very relevant for this story of Christian reincarnationism. But before we look at Simon, perhaps the earliest reincarnationist on record in the Jesus movement construed broadly, let's just point out here at the outset that there really is a specter haunting the history of early Christian reincarnationism, and it is the specter of Gnosticism. There's no need to get into the scholarly criticism of the term Gnostic here again. For more information, see the last installment of this series, or our interview with Michael Williams in episode 80 of the podcast. But with regard to the history of Christian reincarnationism specifically, the fact is that however you want to define Gnosticism as a historical phenomenon, we have Gnostics who teach reincarnation and Gnostics who don't teach reincarnation. And the same goes for early Christians that no one wants to call Gnostics. We have those who teach reincarnation and those who don't. It's true that most of our early Christians who do teach reincarnation, most but not all, have been called Gnostics by someone at some point. But it's worth emphasizing, I think, that by no means all of the so-called Gnostics were reincarnationists. It isn't some kind of signature Gnostic teaching, if any such thing even exists historically. It's also worth emphasizing that we definitely have Christians who did teach reincarnation, whom no one calls Gnostic, as we shall see in this episode. So anyway, let's talk about Simon Magus and Helena. That interesting fellow, Simon the Samaritan, aka Simon Magus or Simon the Sorcerer, was, as I say, a religious entrepreneur of the first century. He shows up in the canonical Acts of the Apostles in the New Testament. This is from Acts 8. But there was a certain man called Simon, which before time in the same city used sorcery, mageuon, and bewitched the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one, to whom they all gave heed from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is the great power of God. And to him they had regard, because that of long time he had bewitched them with sorceries. But when they believed Philip, preaching the things concerning the kingdom of God and the name of Jesus Christ, they were baptized, both men and women. Then Simon himself believed also, and when he was baptized, he continued with Philip, and wondered, beholding the miracles and signs which were done. And when Simon saw that through laying on of the apostles' hands the Holy Ghost was given, he offered them money, saying, give me also this power, that on whomsoever I lay hands he may receive the Holy Ghost. But Peter said unto him, thy money perish with thee, because thou hast thought that the gift of God may be purchased with money. End of quote. This passage is the origin of the sin of simony, which is demanding money for religious power or position in the Christian context. When the podcast gets to the Protestant Reformation period, we will find a whole lot of accusations of simony flying around, because it does indeed become something quite normal for positions in the Catholic Church to be sold to the highest bidder. But anyway, here we see Simon depicted as I say, a religious entrepreneur before the Christian message starts getting spread. The reference to Mageia, sorcery, is presumably a reference to some kind of wonder-working activity, which many later sources attest to as well. And this is an era of wonder-working sages, as we know. We could think of Jesus, we can think of Apollonius of Tyana, there were many others. But then, when the apostles roll through and start doing wonders of their own, Simon jumps on the early Jesus movement bandwagon, but he is rebuffed by Peter when he tries to buy the power that these apostles have. In a paracanonical text, the second century Acts of Peter, we get the classic story about this confrontation. Simon, it turns out, can fly, but Peter causes him to crash to the earth through the power of prayer. In other versions, Simon is flying in a chariot pulled by demons, which is pretty cool, but you get the idea. Sorcery works, but the true faith works better. It's the old story of the Pharaoh's magicians turning their rods into snakes, but then Moses and Aaron's rods turning into snakes and eating the snakes of Pharaoh, right? The other thing to note is that Simon's claims were very ambitious on a more, what you might call, religious side. To whom they all gave heed, from the least to the greatest, saying, "This man is the great power of God." And our later sources also attest to this highly ambitious claim to deity. So two other sources from not that much later help us fill in some of the details about Simon, and this is where things get reincarnational. Justin Martyr tells us that Simon was considered a god, and even had a statue raised to himself at Rome. This is probably a mix-up on Justin's part. And that he went around with a woman named Helen, who was his first thought made flesh. Ten hupatu enoian protein genomenen. Now, this is starting to have a Gnostic ring about it. A female entity lower, ontologically, than the first god. And indeed, we find this specific feminine entity, the prote enoia, or first thought, in many tractates from Nag Hammadi. We find it her in the Pistis Sophia, and so on. But anyway, we don't get any more about Helena from Justin. It's in Irenaeus, in the second century, for whom Simon is the origin of the entire Gnostic heresy, as Irenaeus sees it, that we get more details on Helen's role. Simon's teaching on creation has the first thought, well, there's a whole bunch of emanation from the father, then the first thought is emanated, and she creates the angels, who then create the cosmos. But it turns out these angels are evil archons. And in Schaff's translation, quote, "His enoia was detained by those powers and angels who had been produced by her. She suffered all kinds of contumely from them, so that she could not return upwards to her father, but was even shut up in a human body, and for ages passed in succession from one female body to another, as from vessel to vessel. She was, for example, in that Helen on whose account the Trojan War was undertaken, for whose sake also Stesichorus was struck blind, because he had cursed her in his verses, but afterwards, repenting and writing what are called palinodes, in which he sang her praise, he was restored to sight. Thus she, passing from body to body and suffering insults in every one of them, at last became a common prostitute." End of quote. So, setting aside the insistence of Irenaeus that Helen was a common prostitute, maybe she was and maybe she wasn't, but anyway, aren't Christians supposed to have compassion for those sorts of people? Not Irenaeus. Anyway, setting that aside, what we are looking at here is some kind of reincarnation. Not in the case of a human soul, but rather of a divine hypostasis or divine entity of some kind. Simon himself clearly made claims to being a God-made flesh, but we don't know much about his reincarnations, if there were any. But Helen is his emanation, his enoia, the thought of God made flesh, and she does reincarnate throughout history. You can see echoes of the Christian notion of the Logos made flesh here, right? But typically, for many of the mythologies known as Gnostic, it is a female rather than a male secondary divine principle which has been incarnated. Now, this is a variation of the returning prophet motif, as I'm calling it, rather than of ordinary reincarnation, in quotes. Simon and the Enoia aren't just some random dude and lady who have been reborn. No, Simon himself is an incarnation of some very high-level male divine principle. The sources vary here. That's why I'm not saying exactly how ambitious his claims are, because it's a bit unclear what they were. But he was claiming to be an incarnation of a very exalted aspect of the deity, at least, much as mainstream Christianity would go on to make Jesus. But Helena is his thought or emanation, and she has been reincarnating for some time due to the archons who have kept her trapped in the cosmos. Now, it's way above my pay grade to determine whether it makes sense to speak of Simon as a Christian, right? Does it make sense to talk about Peter as a Christian? Maybe not. But in terms of the Jesus movement, he is definitely involved in the Jesus movement. This seems clear. The other main option would be to refer to him as a non-Christian Gnostic, or even as an example of the fabled pre-Christian Gnostic religion posited by some scholars and debunked by others. But you can say at any rate that we can't do full justice to the history of early Christian reincarnation theory without mentioning Simon and his delightful first thought, since the early Christians themselves are so obsessed with this reincarnated power couple, and they notably never discuss Simon as some kind of non-Christian, but always as, roughly speaking, a heretic, that is, an enemy within, whose teachings have to be combated by the Christian faithful, lest they be seduced by them. Right? So Simon is an interesting case, to say the least. And for more on him, and the swirl of weird and wonderful evidence about him, do see our special episode devoted to him in the Schwepp podcast. Now, turning from the very early Simon, he was so early in the story of Christianity that we could consider him a kind of counter-Paul. Let us turn to the thought of our earliest known Christian philosopher. I refer, of course, to Basilides of Alexandria. But wait, I hear some keen listener say, just what exactly do you mean by equating Simon Magus and Paul of Tarsus? You don't think we're just going to allow you to say that and then move on, do you? Well, okay, gentle listener, if you want that digression, I am here for you in the spirit of the Christmas season. What I mean is that there are some very strong parallels between Simon and Paul. To wit, both men were not members of Christ's original posse, but both jumped on the bandwagon in the first generation or so after Christ's death, and both had teachings which were, well, Gnostic. Now, it's notorious that no actual historical Gnostics seem to have had the full panoply of so-called Gnostic beliefs. This suite of beliefs or teachings, this ideal type of Gnosticism, exists only in the writings of heresiologists and modern scholars like Hans Jonas, whose book The Gnostic Religion probably did more to create the notion of an ancient Gnostic religion than any other work. Now, Simon's teachings, such as we can reconstruct them, show some classic Gnostic traits. And by classic Gnostic traits, I mean classic Hans Jonas-style ideal type stuff. Anti-cosmic pessimism, plus the promise of escape from said evil cosmos. Abrogation of the Jewish law because of a new salvific dispensation. Seeing the world as fallen and ruled by deceptive archons, in this case the creator angels, who then go on to imprison the Ennoia in the cosmos. The descent of a feminine principle into the cosmos through some primordial cock-up. This is all, as I say, classical Gnosticism as found in the scholarship. Okay, well, let's turn to Paul of Tarsus. Anti-cosmic pessimism plus the promise of escape. Abrogation of the Jewish law because of a new salvific dispensation. Seeing the world as fallen and ruled by deceptive archons, in this case literally just called archons, rulers. All of that's just like in Simon Magus. And then Paul has some special Pauline Gnostic sauce of his own, bigging up this thing called pneuma, spirit, and devaluing this other thing called psyche, or soul, like Basilides and many others, teaching that there is a spiritual elite of pneumatics, spirituals, who are the only ones capable of salvation, like Valentinus and many others. If those are Gnostic beliefs, then Paul just is a Gnostic, because he teaches all of these things. And the claim to be an incarnated form of a divine principle? We saw that in Simon, right? What about Paul? Well, we don't have a reincarnation theory in Paul, we do have a weird form of the returning prophet theme, just as we do in Simon. In Paul's case, he claims to be the incarnation of the dead Jesus. I refer, of course, to Galatians 2:20. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. Kind of complicates the history of Christianity and this whole Orthodox versus Gnostic thing, doesn't it? Anyway, as I was saying, let us turn to Basilides of Alexandria. Basilides, as keen listeners know, was discussed in episode 82 of the podcast. He is our earliest known Christian philosopher, roughly speaking. He had some very abstruse and interesting beliefs, a highly apophatic approach to the unsaying of the primal first deity, and much more besides to interest us in the study of Western esotericism. Indeed, in Eusebius's church history, Basilides, rather than Simon Magus, is the founder of Gnosticism. This is the only reference to Gnostics in Eusebius, which some have thought means it was introduced to the text by a later hand, since he doesn't normally talk about Gnostics. But anyway, that's by the by. I might as well flag up here that literally every heresiologist seems to have their own sort of pet ur-Gnostic, and we're going to see some more of them before this episode is done. Now, did Basilides teach reincarnation? There is dispute here. Clement and Origen both describe Basilides as having taught not only transmigration, but transmigration into animal bodies. This seems to have been the old school Hellenic model, inasmuch as transmigration wasn't a desired outcome. It wasn't like a good thing. It was the punishment meted out to those who fell short. What salvation was for Basilides is more unclear, at least to me, but it was some form of escape from the cycle of reincarnation. Now, Pierre Notin has argued that Clement and Origen have it wrong, and that Basilides didn't teach such a thing, while many other scholars argue that he did. We can cite Pearson, an eminent scholar of things early Christian and Gnostic, quote, "On balance, I do not see any reason to doubt that a Platonizing theologian like Basilides, along with a number of other Gnostic teachers, taught the doctrine of reincarnation," end of quote. So I agree with Pearson that this is not a priori at all strange, and we do have the evidence of Clement and Origen saying he taught reincarnation into animals. I'd like to expand, though, and add a significant point here, which will come back later on. We see in these citations from Clement and Origen that they are attacking the notion, which they suppose Basilides taught, that human souls might reincarnate as animals specifically. They're not attacking the notion of transmigration. They're attacking the notion of transmigration into animal bodies. And this they would indeed find objectionable. But as we saw in an earlier episode, many polytheist Platonists also found this objectionable and found various ways of making Plato not teach this doctrine. Does this mean that Clement and Origen are against any idea of transmigration? Hold that thought, as it's relevant, especially for Origen. And as a kind of general side note, across our evidence for early Christianity, we have many attacks on reincarnation, and surprisingly often, they are attacks not on the notion generally, but specifically on 1, animal reincarnation, and 2, not animal reincarnation per se, but because it's a signature doctrine of the Hellenes, of Pythagoras stroke Plato, or of some combination of these identity markers. A huge thrust of both Irenaeus's attacks on the beliefs that he calls Gnostic, and those found in the Refutation of All Heresies, a slightly later heresiological tract, are based specifically in this anti-Hellenic stance. And the whole belief in reincarnation, as Irenaeus expounds at some length, takes its origin from misguided teachings of the philosophers. So the label them as Greeks strategy isn't the only anti-heretical strategy that these and other heresiologists use against the doctrine of reincarnation, but it is a main one. And there is often a soupçon of sleight of hand here. The Greeks, it is understood, specifically teach transmigration into animal bodies, and we Christians just know that this is absurd, right? Right, except that on the one hand, our evidence for early Christian reincarnationism generally excludes belief in animal transmigration. Basilides, if he did indeed teach animal transmigration, is in fact a total outlier here, as in so many of his doctrines. So Basilides isn't typical anything, really. But on the other hand, as we have seen, there wasn't a single Hellenic transmigration doctrine, and many Platonists vocally rejected animal metempsychosis. So the attack by the Christians is something of a lazy red herring. It's constructing a straw man of the Hellenes and then saying they believe this absurd thing that we don't believe. But it's neither true about the Hellenes, nor is it in fact true about the, probably about most of the Christian reincarnationists that they're attacking. They're trying to tar them with the animal reincarnation brush when many of them almost certainly didn't teach animal reincarnation. Anyway, so much for Basilides. Not so much conflicting reports about his teaching, but conflicting scholarly reception of them. Let's turn now to Carpocrates of Alexandria, a Gnostic heresiarch whom we haven't discussed very much on the podcast. Carpocrates, a somewhat later Alexandrian theologian, often described as a Gnostic, seems to have definitely taught transmigration, but in a very specific anthropological context. The normal unspiritual folk are destined to reincarnate over and over, because part of the providential plan is that each soul must undergo the full gamut of possible experiences. Carpocratean Christians, by way of contrast, can cut short the cycle of rebirths and become gods precisely by exhausting all of these experiences in this life. Now, this doctrine gave rise to the accusation among opponents that Carpocrates taught a kind of total hedonism, his followers indulging in every possible carnal sin, and so forth. But we also know that Carpocrates' Jesus was an exemplar of total asceticism, utterly divorced from the pleasures of the flesh, and we are supposed to be like Jesus. So it seems more likely that Carpocrates did teach a kind of renunciation and escape from the cycle of rebirths through total indulgence, a sort of tantric mastering of the passions by diving into them headfirst. But we should keep in mind that if this was his teaching, the ultimate aim of the teaching was utterly transcending these passions and escaping the cycle of reincarnations. So also kind of tantric, actually. Intriguingly, as David Litwa notes, quote, "For Carpocrates, it seems, every last soul experiencing every form of life would be redeemed." In short, Carpocrates is the first attested theologian to support a doctrine of universal salvation. This is probably right, in which case Carpocrates was the first in a very long chain of Christian thinkers which stretches to the modern day and will include other Alexandrians, including Clement and Origen, who support the doctrine of universalism. Now, let's stay with David Litwa for a moment, because he draws in his new book, Early Christianity in Alexandria from its beginnings to the late 2nd century, a very interesting, provocative theological sort of line from Philo of Alexandria through Basilides and Carpocrates, through others, down to Clement and Origen, claiming that reincarnationism was a particularly Alexandrian theological notion. As he says, quote, "Christian notions of transmigration seemed to have flourished only in Alexandria. Based on surviving data, no second century Christian theologian in Italy, Asia Minor, Syria, or Greece advocated this doctrine," end of quote. And he is careful to note the exceptions to the rule here. The famous and influential Christian teacher Valentinus, for example, who lived in the second century and was educated at Alexandria, though he later set up shop in Rome. Valentinus didn't teach cyclical reincarnation, but rather a form of post-mortem angelification through the reuniting of the human soul with its angelic counterpart. So Litwa isn't claiming that all Alexandrian theologians taught this, but he's saying that only Alexandrian theologians taught this. And I think his thesis is a sound one, and I refer listeners to his book for more evidence on the thriving reincarnationist milieu of early Christian theology at Alexandria. But I would like to expand on that thesis a little bit, because while we love the evidence-based argumentation here at the Schwepp, there is kind of a case for much more reincarnationism among early Christians who were not Alexandrians, nor indeed fancy theologians, that can be made on probabilistic grounds. But let's stay in Alexandria for a moment longer. it is in this Alexandrian context that we begin to leave the dodgy category of Gnosticism behind when we get to Clement and Origen. Or are we leaving it behind? Clement is actually more Gnostic than any surviving Gnostic author, if by Gnostic we mean appealing to gnosis, a salvific, esoteric teaching within the exoteric shell of the Christian religion. Because Clement does this all the time. Now, Clement of Alexandria is someone we have devoted much attention to on the podcast. See episodes 90 to 94 and the numerous special episodes we devoted to Clement. And the reasons we've spent so much time on him are numerous, one of them being that Clement really is a case study for an empirically verifiable method of esoteric writing by means of scattering doctrine. He tells us that he is hiding his deeper teachings, those appropriate only to the Gnostics, by scattering them throughout his writings in such a way that only the Gnostic reader will be able to find them. It is the paradox of public hiding and revealing in full effect, gentle listener. But Clement is also just interesting, kind of on every level. Now, we've documented Clement's theory of universal salvation through graduated steps of angelification already on the podcast, at each step of which God's creations become closer to God, while also working to raise up the level of entities below them. All of creation, a kind of mechanism for ascent closer and closer back to God. And while God's goodness is infinite, so it's unclear how or if the creation could ever finally arrive at the destination of God himself, because he's infinitely beyond all creation in goodness and so on, we do know that at the highest ranks of this mechanism of graduated salvation through rebirth are the seven protoctists, the first created beings, whose nature is up for intriguing speculation. And we also find at this, the top of reality, Christ, also known as the world of forms, the noetic demiurge who made the cosmos in the first place. For more on Clement's doctrine here, see episode 94 of the podcast, which draws extensively on the work of Bucur, to which we may now add Yli Karyanma's monograph of 2025 on Clement in his angelification stroke reincarnationist theory. Now, Clement, again, is of interest to us in the context of the question of early Christian reincarnationism, precisely because he isn't a so-called Gnostic, even though, well, gnosis, like I said. What I mean is that neither the anti-reincarnationist and anti-Gnostic polemics of the heresiologists nor modern scholars regard Clement as a Gnostic. Nor does he have a myth of the fall of Sophia or any of the other sort of signature Gnostic mythological tropes in his theory. And his fate within the Orthodox consensus is much more complex than just labeling him a Gnostic or purely Orthodox would make it out. He's widely revered as a holy father of the church, especially in the Eastern Orthodox realm to this day. He's respected by early authors such as Eusebius and, of course, Origen. And generally speaking, the move has been one of adopting him while also condemning many of the specific doctrines for which he argued, notably that of serial angelification. As we mentioned last time, Christians aren't allowed to argue against angelification full stop because it's there in all three synoptic gospels, but they do kind of like to downplay it. But the kind of vast cyclical time frame that Clement paints and the sequence of angels upon angels upon angels that we are actually going to become, the universal salvationist implications of this system are all things which Orthodoxy will roundly condemn, but normally more under the rubric of Origenism rather than of Clementinism. Now, I'm not an expert here, but I get the impression that the reason for this is partly that Origen's reputation, both in his lifetime and thereafter, as such a towering figure of Christian theology, piety, and asceticism wedded to erudition, have just made him a much more urgent target for the emerging Orthodox consensus than Clement was. Clement, I think, was a bit more obscure. Also, the kind of persecution-minded heresiologues who are into detecting and overthrowing heresy may have been precisely the sort of people that Clement was careful not to provoke by writing in the esoteric way that he did. Clement's own take, what he makes explicit, is that he is hiding while revealing the inner teachings of the elders, as he calls them, in order to avoid harming the Christians who early in their spiritual evolution would not be ready to hear the inner truth. So he's protecting those who are not ready for gnosis from gnosis, because if they hear it, they're just going to get it wrong, or it's going to harm them spiritually in some way. But we shouldn't, I think, rule out an attentiveness on Clement's part to the dangers posed by assholes who are already going around in the second century flinging accusations of heresy willy-nilly. You want to hide the inner doctrines from those guys as well. And maybe Clement's esoteric writing style was successful in this regard, right? Such that we still have his writings to some degree, transmitted by Orthodox copyists, and such that he remains a quasi-Orthodox authority, even though he taught cyclical angelic reincarnation. Not actually cyclical, technically, but upward spiraling. And that doctrine just really doesn't exist in Orthodoxy, unless as an esoteric teaching. Now, to finish the story of Alexandrian theology is to discuss the great Origen and his fate as both the most indispensable and the most problematic theologian of the church. Now, you might say, wait, what about Cyril of Alexandria? There's lots of more Alexandrian theology. Fuck Cyril of Alexandria. That guy frosts my ass. As I was saying, to discuss Origen will require a separate episode or two, so stay tuned for that. For now, I will just say that Origen attacks the doctrine of reincarnation a number of times. We are made in the image of God, after all, so we couldn't possibly be reincarnated into animals, right? In fact, he almost always explicitly attacks the doctrine of animal reincarnation. There are two passages in which he attacks it for the notion that it must continue forever. And as a Christian, Origen believes that nothing continues forever down here, since God is going to remake the world and the kingdom of heaven is going to come and everyone will be reborn. Those are his two attacks, mostly animals, and occasionally he attacks the sort of endlessness side of reincarnation. It is thus very easy to read between the lines here and see Origen as pulling a Clement. In effect, what he's saying is, hell no, there's no reincarnation. But were you paying attention? What I actually said was that there is no reincarnation into animal bodies, and that even if there were reincarnation, it couldn't go on forever, because the cycle is going to end with the final judgment and the kingdom of heaven when the creations return to their original noetic state. He's leaving certain doors open. But as I say, we shall return to that next time, because it's worth diving into in detail. For now, I'd like to just pull the focus back for a moment and ask whether Litwa is right in limiting the teaching of reincarnation in early Christianity to the Alexandrian milieu. In terms of hard evidence, surviving theological texts, I think he is right, although much depends, or actually everything depends here, on the dating of many loose sectarian texts that survive only in late antique copies. Texts like the Nag Hammadi writings or the Pistis Sophia. If some of these are indeed as early as the second century, we may have evidence for non-Alexandrian reincarnationism among Christians in the first two centuries. But we don't know. Also, we would need to rule out the evidence about Simon Magus as either being not Christian or alternatively not really reincarnationist. I mean, if you don't want to read the sort of returning prophet motif as a form of reincarnation argument, then Simon is out of the discussion. But okay, in terms of theological argumentation from the early centuries of Christian theology, the one place where people were arguing for reincarnation seems to have been in the particular confluence of Jewish thought and Hellenic philosophy that was Alexandria's early Christian community. However, and this is where we're getting into my probabilistic argument alluded to earlier, which is has to remain in thought experiment territory, because I don't have hard proof for this. If we want to credit the heresiologists, there were a number of sects who were teaching reincarnation and who seemingly had nothing to do with Alexandria. And while, again, dating becomes a crux here, we don't, I think, have strong reasons to assume that none of these movements existed in any form before the 3rd century, which is the earliest that most scholars, whose work I've seen, will be willing to date texts like the Pistis Sophia or some of the more openly reincarnationist Nag Hammadi writings. Irenaeus, writing in the 2nd century, has a whole chapter refuting the notion of transmigration, but he doesn't really name names. Earlier on, he does single out Simon and Helen as having claimed transmigration, but in his chapter attacking transmigration, he just singles out Plato and the Hellenes more generally and argues against reincarnation on what you might call philosophic grounds. Still, the fact that he takes time to refute the notion could be read as implying that there must be some heretical reincarnationism around worth refuting, right? We don't have much evidence to support the Simonians, the putative followers of Simon Magus. I mean, we do have evidence of people thinking they exist, but we don't have much evidence of their existing, at least not for very long after Simon died. Origen says that they have died out in his day completely. But we might think that the Simon-hating Irenaeus is addressing his attacks here specifically against the Simonians, if they existed in the 2nd century. But anyhow, even if there were no Simonians around, one is tempted to speculate that Irenaeus is aware of arguments for reincarnation being made in some form in his day within the church, and that's why he feels obliged to attack the doctrine. Otherwise, why bother? Now, turning to the refutation of all heresies, a bit later than Irenaeus, again, a text attributed to Origen in some of the manuscripts, long attributed by scholars to Hippolytus of Rome, or then to pseudo-Hippolytus, but since the manuscripts never said it was by Hippolytus in the first place, it doesn't really make sense to attribute it to pseudo-Hippolytus. It's just an anonymous text for our purposes. Anyway, in this text, we actually get some names and even some specific flavors of Christian reincarnationism discussed. There are the Naasenes, who appear in the refutation as the Arch-Gnostics, like Irenaeus' Simon Magus or Eusebius' Basilides. Now, actually, our author, like Irenaeus, wants to trace all Gnostic heresy ultimately to the Hellenes. He mentions Pythagoras, Empedocles, and Plato by name in different contexts, and he also brings in, you know, wandering astrologers and fictional mysteries and all this kind of stuff. But the proximate Arch-Gnostics are the Naasenes, who took the doctrines of these Hellenic philosophers and, in essence, have invented a new thing, Gnosticism. And the Naasenes teach reincarnation, although we don't get the details of how it's supposed to work. Our author also attacks the reincarnationist Docetae, or Docetists. They use the references in the New Testament writings to John the Baptist being a reincarnation of Elijah that we talked about last time, and they use this to argue for transmigration, which, however, has come to an end with the coming of the Savior. There's another form of reincarnationism. Incidentally, this is the kind of perfectly Christian theory of reincarnation, which could be what Origen is saying without saying, right? If we want to read him as being an esoteric reincarnationist, this would be a perfect fit with his denials of reincarnation. You denied all the stuff, but you didn't deny this specific Docetist doctrine. Anyway, another group is the Elkaicites, a group who taught a very strong form of the returning prophet model. In Litwa's translation of the Refutation of All Heresies, quote, "They believe in a single Christ above, who transmigrates numerous times into numerous bodies, and was recently incarnated in Jesus. Likewise, he is sometimes born from God, while at other times he becomes spirit. Sometimes he is born from a virgin, at other times not." Later on, he continues his never-ending transmigration into bodies and is manifested in many different bodies at various times. End of quote. That's about as returning prophet motif as you can get. Now, we could go on here, bringing in the evidence of Epiphanius' Panarion and other early-ish heresiological works. These authors all condemn various groups of so-called heretics, mention that some of them taught some form of reincarnationism and argue against this teaching in various ways. But here is the question that I have anyway. When there's smoke, is there fire? That is to say, if these heresiologists were busy attacking reincarnation as a doctrine, sometimes naming names, naming sects who maintained this doctrine, are we to assume that these sects did exist and that we have a flourishing Christian reincarnationism for centuries into the Christian era, or at least from the time of the earliest heresiologists, so say from the second century onwards? Well, while this cannot exactly be proven, it seems awfully probable to me. I don't see any easy way to doubt it, in fact. Even if we're correcting very hard for the developing anti-heretical ideology we see in authors from Justin to Epiphanius and beyond, with all its kind of classicizing tropes, it's hard to imagine them just inventing groups like the Nassines and sort of seeing Nassines under the bed if there really weren't any Nassines at all, right? I mean, as a thought experiment, heresiologists will have been opposed to things like human sacrifice, of course, right? But we don't have heresiologists bothering to attack human sacrifice among Christian heretics. Presumably, this is because there wasn't any. So they don't bother to argue against human sacrifice because no one's arguing for it. So I'm personally confident that these sects did exist in some form, and I think they were most likely persuasions among rank-and-file Christians rather than kind of separate churches, which is how the heresiologues try to paint them. So later on, in later antiquity, we do have some evidence that certain, you know, as lines hardened among Christians, some of these groups did develop into separate churches. There's some evidence for, like, Valentinian churches, for example. But in the first four centuries, I think these are just Christians. We're all doing the same thing, trying to figure out what this Christianity thing is, and passing books around and reading interesting weird ideas and so on. But this would be a picture in which there are Christians in the welter of trying to figure out what Christian eschatology is in the first four centuries. A lot of Christians are using reincarnation as part of that story, right? The question still is one of dating. To return to Litwa's claim that in the first two centuries of Christian teaching, we only find reincarnation at Alexandria, again, setting Simon Magus aside. Well, our evidence for the so-called Gnostic groups like the Nassines, the Elchisites, the Docetae, and others, you know, starts to show up by name in the early third century. And we have original texts as well, which also sort of seem to date to no earlier than the third century, roughly. The Pistis Sophia is a great example. In section 147, this non-Nag Hammadi Gnostic text, so-called, it lays out a whole theory of post-mortem reward and punishment, and just kind of lets slip as an aside that reincarnation is assumed to be going on in the background to the whole scheme. Now here again, the dating is probably the 3rd century at the earliest. Our unique manuscript of this text is from the 4th century, but you know, many of the ideas can be traced back at least someone earlier. Incidentally, the salvation scheme of the Pistis Sophia has really interesting echoes with that of Mani, such that Mani either certainly read it, or whoever wrote the Pistis Sophia certainly read Mani. But we'll get to that and the Virgin of Light and the astral aspects of reincarnation when we get to Mani in a few episodes. To sum up all of this evidence for now, I think it's just to say the following, based on our evidence. One, we definitely see a flourishing of reincarnationist ideas, often bound up with notions of the returning prophet theme and angelification in the early Christian intellectual milieu of Alexandria. Two, we can also say that from the early 3rd century onward at least, we have a whole dossier of evidence, some heresiological, but some found in texts of actual sectarians, like the Pistis Sophia and some of the Nag Hammadi writings. We haven't had time to go into those, but see the recommended reading for some secondary discussions relevant to reincarnation in some of the Nag Hammadi corpus. All of this evidence pointing to groups of Christians who believed in reincarnation in one form or another, again, often with flavor of returning prophet and flavor of angelification. Thirdly, there is kind of a gap in the evidence here between Alexandria and these sects, but is there really? While we should be as skeptical as possible about the claims of the various sects to go back right to the founding of Christianity, you know, the refutation has the Nassians claiming to be in a direct line from James the Just, the first head of the Jerusalem church. You know, all Christian groups have these origin myths. The Catholics and the Orthodox have their own versions of these origin stories. And the Pope still displays the keys of St. Peter, you know. So why wouldn't the so-called Gnostics have them as well? But exercising due skepticism to all such things, and without diving into the literally endless debates, I'll just say that we know that there were Basilidean Christians in later centuries. We know there were Carpocratians in later centuries. And we know that the heresiologists are always harping on about how reincarnation is a wrong Christian teaching. And I think the easiest, most plausible explanation to make sense of all of that is simply to assume that, generally speaking, both sides of the ancient debate are correct. There was, from very early on in Christianity's intellectual history, a range of beliefs in reincarnation, and that different sects were teaching different versions of it for hundreds of years. How early it goes, how you get from Simon Magus to the Nassians and their ilk, is a bit of a gap in our evidence, but I'm not going to let it concern me unduly. I think early Christianity was, if anything, such a ripe field for wild speculation, and the question of eschatology was so wide open, as we sort of tried to emphasize in the last episode, that it's in no way a stretch to imagine numerous sects having reincarnation as part of their eschatological teaching. And lastly, but not leastly, four, I just said that, you know, a range of beliefs in reincarnation was being taught for hundreds of years among certain Christian sectarians. Looking forward, we will see that this is actually more like thousands of years. But for now, having surveyed the scene in the first four centuries vis-a-vis reincarnation among Christians, we want to return to Alexandria to pay a visit to the last great Alexandrian theologian. It is around the name of Origen that the greatest controversies of the 4th, 5th, and even 6th centuries swirled, and one of the many points of contention was the notion that Origen might have had an esoteric doctrine of metempsychosis. Join us in part 8 of the series when we get deep into the evidence about Origen and reincarnation with Jonathan Young, who has researched this question in some detail. Until then, stay esoteric.